Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I am here with Dr. Linda Luber, assistant professor in the Department of Economics here at Morgan State University, research associate with the Institute for Urban Research, and Dr. Steven Isberg, associate professor of finance at the Merrick School of Business at the University of Baltimore. Good to see you, Steve and Linda. Good to have you in the room.
Good morning. Good morning.
Two of my favorite economic scholars here in the studio. Good to have you both here. And also do your political commentary. I mean, one thing I see, you're both very grounded, maybe in different ways, so looking at the world, but very grounded, which I think is important for us to listen to at the moment. So let's talk a bit about what this crisis was about to start with. What does it mean? What did it mean that we could have not raised the debt ceiling, that the government would have run out of money? What does that mean, Linda? And then over to Steve. How would you analyze it for the listeners to really figure out what this brinkmanship meant to us if we had failed?
Well, because we issue bonds to help pay for our debt, people across the world actually buy these, which means that we owe them the money plus the interest. So if we're not going to be paying them, we are then doing something to other countries and other people that's basically against the law. And so we're defaulting. And that is kind of the crux of not paying our debt. And what we were getting to, and this brinkmanship of tying the Affordable Care Act to this, that was what they wanted, not to have that, and that was kind of the start of all of this. And that wasn't going to work, and yet they were still reluctant to let's do what we need to do, because the dollar is tied so much across the world. And other currencies are backed by the dollar. And so when we start defaulting, that is causing this ripple effect throughout the world and not just here in the United States.
Steve.
I'd agree with everything Linda just said. And it's interesting. This is the 45th time now since President Reagan that we've raised the debt ceiling. And, you know, about 40 of the other times, it was barely news. And why is that? I think what we're seeing is an increasing degree of polarization, which is very evident in the U.S. Congress, and also becoming more and more evident, I think, in U.S. society, the polarization of income levels, polarization of political points of view. And, you know, what's kind of sad is that we're kind of losing that common middle ground where we can come together and negotiate our way out of solving problems. And our ability to solve practical problems is being significantly impaired. And if you take a look at what these, call them negotiators in big quotes, were willing to put at risk here, what they're willing to put at risk when you talk about the things that Linda was just mentioning, what would a default?
Yeah, what would have that meant? Let's say that the Tea Party caucus did not allow this to go through and said, we're blocking it, we don't care what Bonner said, Boehner says, whatever his name is, that I kept it clean, but what would it have meant?
Well, since 1944, the Bretton Woods Agreement, the world has been on a U.S. dollar standard. All right? We're no longer on a gold standard. There's nothing backing currencies worldwide other than confidence that they're going to be good, that they're going to be useful for something. And what backs most currencies is the U.S. dollar. And if the world starts to lose confidence in the U.S. dollar, that whole world financial system is at risk, significant risk. About 50% of what we owe is owed to foreign investors. And, you know, they look to the U.S. as a safe place to invest. If that look changes now, what will that mean for the ability of the U.S. government to continue to borrow at low rates? If the rates go up, the burden of maintaining that debt service is going to be heavier. It's going to put more pressure on the federal deficit. And, you know, you'll get that – you'll get a problem that will start to spin out of control even faster than it is right now.
So what you just said, Steve, you know – I think this is important to kind of explore just for a minute, just get the background for our listeners to understand this. All of us understand this is complex. When Steve just said that the economic state of the world is no longer based on gold and has been for a long time, but is based on the American dollar, then A, it makes sense when people talk about foreign investment in American currency and in American debt, because that would be the basis of their stability, because they're investing in something they think is stable. Right?
Exactly.
So we always cry about all these foreigners own the American debt, but the reason is because we are
stable.
We are the definition of what is economic value and the value of people's us.
Right. If I could just point out, the South African ambassador was here yesterday and was talking about how the interest rates are for like the things in Africa are like really high compared to the interest rate that you would get here in the United States for like bond. But the deal is that what wasn't said is that how stable do you look at that when you would, if you were purchasing a bond from someplace in the United States versus someplace in Africa. And so even though the interest rate might be higher, you still there has been this perception that the United States is holding this very stable, secure, reliable, something where you could invest your money, basically, and get interest.
So we did reach this temporary debt ceiling. It goes until January, is that right?
Well, they just lifted the current ceiling. They haven't done anything to increase it. They've just basically suspended it.
All right, so we'll come back. I'm going to come back to define what that means. We just suspended it. Let's not forget to come back to that. I really want to understand what that means. But what it also seems to mean is that what we've done, this is not a permanent fix. So how does that affect this country and the rest of the world in terms of our economics?
Well, the underlying problem is still there. I mean, no. They haven't done anything about the underlying problem. If anything, by deferring a significant decision on how to handle the U.S. budget problem and how to handle the problem of the rapidly increasing debt. And I'll put this in perspective, okay? If we go back to 1981 when we were talking about a debt ceiling, we were talking about $900 billion. Now we're talking about $16.7 trillion. And just 4 years ago, that was 11.3. So we're talking about an increase of 50% in that debt ceiling over the last 4 years, which is huge.
And there's been a lot of talk, and a lot of things I've read over the last few months, that we are facing ever increasing possibility of new economic bubbles bursting in this country.
I'm not sure that. Some new ones. I mean,
I wouldn't call it new,
right? So, you know, that we've been through the housing bubble. I'm not sure where we would be seeing a bubble come out.
Well, we're talking about the way people are bundling things and selling them.
Oh, okay.
That these things could explode just like the bundling exploded around housing and mortgages, and they're bundling everything at the moment, that they're all kind of based on literally nothing, and that they could also come back to haunt us, to compounding the problem of debt.
I think what you might be alluding to, Mark, is if you take a look at the impact of let's say, Dodd-Frank and what that's done in the financial industry, and are they still playing around with derivatives, and are they still playing around with these sophisticated financial packages? Probably yes, and probably more than they did before it all crashed. You know, Lynn and I both looked at each other and said, well, what's new? The economy's been realigning with the global economy for years. I mean, this has been a long, drawn-out process. The real significant tipping point, I think, was the mid-1990s when the Chinese fixed their exchange rates to the U.S. dollar. We have been realigning with the global labor markets, and labor market conditions have changed. And, you know, the significant weakness in the economy right now, if you take a look at the numbers, appears to be consumer spending.
And on that line, we have to take a very quick break. We have to go to Pledge Central, and we'll be right back with this conversation.
What, dinner?
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are here now with Dr. Stephen Isberg, Associate Professor of Finance at the Merrick School of Business at the University of Baltimore, and Dr. Linda Loubert, Assistant Professor in the Department of Economics at Morgan State University. She's also a Research Associate with the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State. 4103. Oh, no, we're not doing that now. We are just talking because if you call 403-198-8888, you get the pledge line, and
you've
got
it. But you can still call.
You can still call, and they're waiting. So where we left off, so when you look at, what were you about to say something? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just wanting to maybe lay the background for how we get to this point of even consideration. The fact that it is the president that's decides on a budget for the United States. He sends that budget to Congress. The Congress then has to approve it. And that's where we started with this problem. And you have to also remember that we're just trying to pay what is due and be at a place where we're paying what is due. And that's where we started with, you know, oh, this is a time where the Tea Party says, oh, let's now hold this thing whole hostage by, because we tried 42 times to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and didn't go through. So mm-hmm. now let's use this as a ploy to stop, because everyone should know that we have to give the final word on this budget. It's the Congress. And I also want to point out one thing that about women. The women in the Senate did really come kind of like say, come on, guys, let's you know, all this horseplay. Let's That's really right. get down That's to right. business
it was
here.
The women.
Okay. Anyway, I just
which
wanted say, to...
Which says a lot. And we can talk a bit about that in about 10 minutes or so to really get into that whole question of why it took the women to make this happen in the U.S. Senate and what we have to learn about that in terms of political sharing, political power in America, and not always being white men talking. No, I have nothing against white men either, but sometimes. 410-319-8888.
Not that you're a white man talking. So.
Sometimes. So, now, Steve, let's talk, though, a bit about both of you, because I think in some ways you have maybe different views on how we should approach the debt. I mean, there are arguments that how we control costs are a real debate in this country. Some people would argue that the way you control costs is to really control health care costs. We have people here who said if you control health care costs in America, pharmaceuticals, the way hospitals charge, insurance rates, and more, we wouldn't have a debt problem in the United States of America. There's that argument that was made very strongly by several guests on the show when we were arguing about the future of medical care in America. There are those that you have to infuse the American economy with more money to push infrastructure to make it grow. Other things, less regulation, you need to just cut the debt and cut what people call entitlements, which is my Social Security, someone else's Medicare, and someone else's Medicaid, and whatever else that means. So have at it for a moment about what you think it all means.
Well, let me just start, Steve, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
So we understand that it's the taxes that come in to the government that really help to pay for all the services and things that the government does. All right, so one thing, the amount of taxes hasn't been enough to do all of that. And we also have to remember, all right, so money goes out for Medicare and Medicaid, but money also, you know, we have to pay for the interest that over the past however many years that we've had to pay on our debt. So there's a lot of things that are a part of where we are now, that we're at some $16 trillion in debt. So just to put it on one particular thing is really not the answer. But we also have to remember the money's coming in. We've allowed that 1% of our, you know, of those who make the most money not to really contribute as much as they possibly could. We've allowed kinds of tax loopholes, all kinds of things. So it's not there's not a one fix, and we really do have to pay attention to a lot of things, and particularly how we've not allowed the monies that could be coming in to come into the government.
So, and Steve Ginsburg, take a shot before we go back to Pledge Central here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, basically, I'm typically philosophically an advocate of a free market solution. Mm. I have faith in people's ability to engage in exchange, and under conditions of equality, under conditions where they're protected against the use of fraud and force, under conditions where there's not an a priori claim against them for whatever reason. So, you know, you go back to the time of slavery. There was an a priori claim on someone just because of who they were, what they were. You know, right now, if you try to fix the problem by just turning a free market loose, everybody starts at a different place. You've got different starting lines. And a huge group of people would start well ahead of others. So can you allow a free market solution to work this out? Right now, I think we've done so much damage to that over the last 100 years that if you did that, you would just basically lock in the disparities that we're already seeing in our economy. And they would get worse. and income disparities would continue to widen, poverty problems would continue to deepen, and I don't think we'd see an economy, the economy grow. So the real question I'm struggling with right now as a professional economist is, well, okay, if we are going to fix this problem, what kind of mechanisms do we need to put in place to, A, stop the bleeding, and then, B, heal the patient, get the patient back to the point where they can rely on a market mechanism to solve this problem long term? Because, you know, there's absolutely no sustainable outlook for what we're doing right now. All we've done in the last day, all Congress has done in the last day, is it can push the problem a little further down the road. It's only going to get bigger. It's not going to get any better. And if you look at what this economy would do if you left it on its own without the government intervention over the last 5 years, I'm pretty confident that we would have experienced a significant deflation. I think along with that deflation, we would have had huge debt defaults. Of course, the biggest debtor is the U.S. federal government, and that would have created problems bigger than what we're looking at now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've kind of put that off, and I think justifiably so. I don't think we could have allowed a crisis of that proportion to occur. But, you know, we're still under that cloud. We haven't gotten through that problem yet, and we have to figure out, you know, what it is we're going
to
do.
So we have to give a brief break and go back to Plaid Central here, and we're going to be joined by two other guests in a moment as well to continue this discussion. And what this kind of this says to me is that sometime in the next week or two, we will probably bring some of these guests back to have a real discussion on the future of economic future of this country and the world from a free market position, from the position of a liberal large government position, and from the position of the left, and see where we all fit and see it should go. So we're in a brief break. We got to go to Plaid Central. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we continue our conversation about the state of where America is at the moment. We are still here with our two guests who were here earlier in the studio to chime in, Dr. Stephen Isberg and Dr. Lynn Loubert. And we're joined now by Marta Mossberg, who has joined us many times, nationally syndicated columnist, and Amara Jones, economic justice contributor for CallLines.com, who served in the Clinton White House, where he worked in international trade policy. So, Amara and Marta, welcome. Good to have you both with us again.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
You know, Mark, I wanted to add that oxytocin, I think, is also released by eating hot peppers.
Not Oreos. Oreos are supposed to be like heroin.
So sometimes it's painful.
That's funny. Don't eat a hot pepper, just pledge. 410-319-8888. Then eat a hot pepper. So let me ask you, Marta, let me start with Marta and then go over to Amara. So what do you think was going through some of your Republican colleagues' minds when they did this blockage and knew it was – as someone wrote to me last night, they said, this reminds me of Custer going into Little Bighorn. I mean, without any thought about what the consequences were. Yeah. What was happening, do you think, politically?
You know, I think that some people just – all they want – you know, they're so upset with the direction of the government that they want – they just want to fight. And but fighting, there's a great column this morning by Stuart Rothenberg. He's talking about how fighting is a motto, it's not a strategy. And so going forward, in order to change things, you need a strategy. And some people have to be brought around to that idea.
Amara, what did we just see?
A mess. I don't, you know, that's the elegant term for
it. Was that a scholarly statement? A mess?
Yes, exactly. I mean, well, what we saw was actually the result of a three-year strategy by the Tea Party. I mean, this was not, the shutdown was not an accident. The flirtation with default weren't an accident. It's one of the end games that they had laid out and their backers had laid out in 2010 when they came to power. It just didn't play out like they wanted it to. And my concern is that, you know, given the fact that these are true believers, that these are diehards, and that they are backed by hundreds of millions of dollars, I mean, as the New York Times wrote a couple of weeks ago, they've spent almost $300 million over the last year getting ready for the shutdown. That there was money to fund a movement in which, in August alone, they had made over 60,000 calls to members of Congress pushing for a shutdown. So that entire network hasn't gone anywhere. And there's no reason to think, unfortunately, that we won't end up here again.
Marta, let other guests kind of chime in too if they like on this
well,
one.
But you know,
Marta,
go ahead, please. I could not hear anything that Amara just said, so I don't know if there's a way
to. Oh man, that's terrible. We have to get our. So basically, he was saying, if I paraphrase this wrong, Amara, leap in and I'll kind of be like a translator here in English
Thank
to
you.
English.
I don't know what it was.
It's not your fault. It's clearly something technical here, which means you got to call 410-319-8888 so we make our make sure our system works here. It costs money. But what he's basically saying was that this has been a long-time plan, that $300 million was spent to leading up to this shutdown, 60,000 phone calls to made to get letters to come into Congress to stop the Affordable Care Act and shut the government down. And this was a paid-for movement to shut down the government. And that was paid for by a lot of very wealthy Americans to make this happen.
Well,
this was what Amara was saying.
The bigger issue to me is that Obamacare is not very popular. And a lot of the people who acted in Congress, you know, as unconstructive as a lot of people think that, you know, what they did was, it was based on the fact that a majority of Americans are not happy with what's going on. So,
but a majority of Americans also said they wanted not to have the government shut down and let Obamacare have Affordable Care Act have its day and see if it works. That was the other part of it, though.
Well, I think that, I think that Obamacare is going to implode. I mean, and it already is, given the rollout and what we've seen in the past few weeks. But I think a lot of people wanted to stop it before it started because they thought it's so bad, we should never inflict this on the American people. I mean, what's going to happen is that it's going to move forward and we'll find out what's in it. And it's going to be more, you know, it's going to cost us, you know, billions of more dollars and not obviously save money for many people who want to sign up. I mean, this is, for many people, this is doubling, if not tripling in some cases, the cost of their insurance.
Can I just add something?
Marta, go ahead, please.
And hopefully Marta can hear me.
I can now.
Go, good, good. We're all hearing each other. Go ahead, Amara.
The problem here is this was not about Obamacare. That this was about stopping and changing a government that they believed has been hijacked by people who don't have America's interests at heart, and from whom they wanted to wrest it. And so that's why there wasn't concern about the fact that there were 10,000, you know, tens of thousands of Americans who went without nutrition assistance and Head Start and all of the things that we have seen go on, and that this has been a giant punch to the solar plexus of our economy at a time when we did not need it. And so that's the issue. And to say that somehow, well, the larger issue really is Obamacare, when we've just witnessed the United States almost enter into a financial catastrophe and may not be able to avoid some sort of economic setback as a result of it, is astounding.
I think that Obamacare was kind of the tip of the iceberg. I would agree that this has bigger implications, but Obamacare was the main reason people responded like this. They felt this was the last last-ditch effort that they had in order to stop something so horrible that it meant more to them than anything else. What you believe in is something that the United States is about. You may not agree with that, but I find it hard to believe that you wouldn't fight just as vociferously and vehemently for something that you believed if you thought it was wrong.
I actually would not hijack the government. There are a lot of things that Democrats felt really strongly about, including war and peace, including the fact that we spent $1 trillion in Iraq and that there were 100,000 Iraqis who lost their lives and thousands of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Americans with mental and physical wounds. That was a deeply felt policy difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. Democrats never threatened
votes
to hijack the government and to shut down the entire government just because of that war. And the difference here is that there is a group of people organized in the Republican Party who have billions of dollars, who are willing to spend hundreds of millions in order to use people's dissatisfaction with a policy in order to achieve a larger goal.
So we have to take a quick break. Go back to Pledge Central, come back to some closing thoughts. It's the closing thoughts we're coming back to from all four of our guests on this. And I appreciate them all being here on this very crazy busy day for our fall pledge drive, our fall membership drive. Stay with us. We're going to Pledge Central with Coley and Leah. We'll be right back. Oh, 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 oh. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're going to have a little round robin here. Let everybody have kind of a final say on where we think it is. And see, that takes us to the age when we have to go back to Pledge Central, which is to talk about the future of the economy. Linda LeBaire's got her hand up, so we can let Linda start. It was like, I feel like I'm a school teacher again. Linda.
I want to just point out something. We were talking about how there's been this money behind some of these campaigns to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. One of the things that we also need to pay attention to is that after the 2010 census, we came up with a lot of redistricting, and a lot of it was gerrymandered just so that we could have Republican districts, so that we could be able to put more Republicans into the office. And because
are you forgetting Maryland?
Well, let me finish.
And so because of that, across the country, and not just one little state of Maryland, across the country, we've seen a lot more areas that have become Republican because of the gerrymandering that was done with the redistricting that took place. So I think we need to keep that in mind when we're thinking about, well, who is in Congress and who they're representing. But when you talk about a city, you may be talking about one kind of weird angle of that city and not maybe the whole city. And so, and another thing I want to point out is that many times we have a lot of African Americans or even minorities in places who don't go and vote, and yet that could be a problem when you're talking about these districts that have been now realigned so that they hold more Republican registered voters. So I just think we need to keep that in mind when we're looking at this whole catastrophe and what some of the backdrop of it has been.
Let's go to Steven Newsberg, then Marta Mossberg, and then to Amara. Steven?
Well, my big question is, which America does Congress represent right now? Mm. I think one of the interesting things is we're starting to see economically disenfranchisement that's going to extend beyond racial lines and beyond ethnic lines and beyond gender lines. I think it's infusing into American society, this disenfranchisement, primarily on income class lines. So my question for Congress is, who do you represent? As far as solving the problem, I'd say it's a 100-year-old seed with 70-year-old roots and a 40-year-old growing tree. What's that? 100 years ago, we founded the Fed. 70 years ago was the Bretton Woods Agreement, where the world went on a dollar standard, and 40 years ago we took the dollar off the gold standard. And ever since then, we've had a total lack of monetary discipline in this economy, and the money supply has continuously grown, and income has been redistributed along the way, and the American consumer has been hit by steadily creeping inflation that unbelievably averages over 4% since 1970. Mm. So if you think about the impact of prices increasing by an average of 4% a year since 1970, that's what American society is dealing with right now. That's why we have the income and wealth disparity.